I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
My name is Aaron Ryan, and the indomitable Bill Cundiff is out sick today. He has been overtaken by shingles. So I will spare you my my shingles thing, but you should really look into whether or not you've had chicken pox, and you were like me, mistrustful and suspicious of things like vaccine that they always want you to have. I'm like, just the fact that they want me to have it tells me I don't want to have it most of the time. Yeah, I had to kind of rethink that one on this after watching Bill down the drain for 3+ weeks. So we hope to have him back soon among the living. So let's see. There's something going on in the engineering room. Something's going on with thumbs up that requires
Kurt
thumbs up.
Curtain is on the phone.
Get out. Climate change has returned. My goodness.
It's back with a vengeance.
We were going to have to stalk you, and, well, you know, we just played Ring of Fire, so you kind of know what we were thinking.
Well, our church service went long. I don't know why.
that's where you tell God you got to go.
Yeah, I didn't have my phone on, like, loud, so it just went to silent. I always put on silent at church. Anyway,
right.
I'm back.
Right, and then you saw, who is this Aaron Ryan person who keeps calling me repetitively? I'm going to need to file some sort of a restraining order.
That's right.
And then you were like, hey, wait a second, I remember her. Holy crap, what time is it? So, all right, I have been reiterating on the Prop 50 sadness and madness in that order, and just finished. We were getting ready to move on to something else, so glad you...
Interestingly enough, you know, it's kind of like, I like it when Trump plays chicken and they don't know how to play chicken.
Yeah.
They don't even know they're playing chicken. You know, he throws it out there, then they react. It almost like a conditioned response.
Yeah. I think Pavlov probably, you know...
It's pretty funny. Anyway.
Yeah, he set that up. I already gave your bio at the very beginning. So all we know about you is you were a teacher and... Whoops, sorry about that. Turn my phone. Now I can turn my phone off because now you're not going to call me anymore.
Right.
You have a background in geology and teaching sciences, and you have a unique perspective on man-made climate change, global warming, and that debate that never happens because we never get a seat at the table.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I like to emphasize, especially when talking to people who don't know much about the topic, but they hear a lot about it. For example, you're talking to your average Joe on the street, and you ask them the random question, you know, how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, and they say, a lot. I say, well, how much percentage? Like, for example, 21% oxygen. And they say, okay, they'll maybe say so. I've seen as high as 60%, and I've seen as low as, like, 5%. Rarely, to the point where it's like, it surprised me when they say, oh, yeah, 0.038% or 400 parts per million, which is trace.
Yeah.
That reduces down to one molecule of carbon dioxide for every, get this, for every 2,500 parts of atmosphere. So 400 parts per million
Right. Is
one molecule for every 2,500. So you have a 2,500 dollar bills floating around. One of those dollar bills is carbon dioxide. And of that little carbon dioxide dollar bill, we contribute 4 pennies to it, 4 cents. So that 4 cents, that 4% of the world's carbon dioxide that we're actually contributing to, and that's actually being generous, it's absurd. It's absurdity upon absurdity. It's thermodynamic nonsense. Secondly, carbon dioxide is a gas. It's a natural occurring gas. It's an important gas. It's a gas of life. All plants need it to live. And photosynthesis has to be what keeps our planet alive. Without photosynthesis, there's no more life. They're producers. So we need plants to live. The healthier the plants, the healthier the planet, the healthier the life is on this planet, let's say. So carbon dioxide has been as high as 2,500 parts per million. And as low, and we're at the lowest scheme now, we're at 400 parts per million. We've had it like 350 to 325, you know, based on Volstock ice core samples. For example, that would be ice cores that formed in Volstock, Antarctica, kind of given the basic reading of how much oxygen and nitrogen and so forth is in the atmosphere at the time. Carbon dioxide being most of the time traced and giving readings as high as 2,500 parts, that's a lot. That's great. That would be like if you're in a greenhouse in Switzerland, for example. In Switzerland, they're very smart people. They're very productive people. I was there, and I asked about these greenhouses, and they said, yeah, we pump in carbon dioxide in there to get a bigger crop faster with less water. Because when you have more carbon dioxide, you become more drought resistant because you don't have to have your stomata open so long that you lose water through transpiration. So anyway, getting back to carbon dioxide, it's a great gas. It's trace. We contribute very little. But carbon dioxide, people don't know this either, it only holds heat while the sun is on it. So if the sun is out, it's hitting carbon dioxide, well, it will create a little heat. It'll hold it for a little while. Once the sun goes down, there's the problem. Problem is, it doesn't hold heat unless the sun is actually beating on it. Now, interestingly enough, if you go to Hawaii, where I used to hang out a lot, I would sleep outside under the stars, you know, look at the palm trees if it wasn't raining and so forth, go outside. I would sleep without a blanket. It was so warm there because water vapor happens to be the world's number one and most effective greenhouse gas because it holds heat all night. How's that one? It might get a little cooler at night, but not as much because water vapor holds heat all night. So as soon as you, say for example, a solar eclipse goes over Colorado like it did in 2017. Standing outside, it was 80 degrees. This is a report from a friend of mine that was there. 80 degrees, t-shirt weather, solar eclipse goes over in 2017. He said it went from 80 to 65 in seconds. He says within 10 seconds he's telling his wife, wow, feel that cold. We got shivers. We were thinking about getting jackets on, and so my wife went and got and so forth, right? So he told me this whole story. I said, yeah, because water vapor only holds heat while the sun is on it. You block it with a planet, or a moon, let's say, and now we've got 5 minutes max of cold. And then it goes past and it starts warming up again. So the point is this. Carbon dioxide, yay, is a greenhouse gas, but it is very ineffective at doing what greenhouse gases do, holding heat. So it's not even a player. It's trace. We contribute very little of it. And it doesn't even do anything with regards to the greenhouse gas effect of holding heat and moving it. That's what greenhouse gas, like water vapor, holds heat and moves it around. It's thermodynamics. So it is utterly thermodynamic absurdity to believe that carbon dioxide actually is an effective gas that runs the climate. Water vapor, number one greenhouse gas. 95% of the world's greenhouse gas is water vapor. The other would be other gases like carbon dioxide and methane, which, by the way, is 2 parts per million. That's 2 little molecules for every million molecules of our atmosphere. It is thermodynamic absurdity. If you say that cow farts are causing climate change, you need to have your whatever degree you have revoked immediately for utter and complete absurd incompetence in the knowledge of the science that you're supposedly being an expert.
No pun intended on the whole utter thing.
Yes. So anyway, there's a little rendition about carbon dioxide and its importance for life. The more of it, the better. It is a greenhouse gas, but it doesn't act like a greenhouse gas in the sense that it actually holds heat and does anything important with the weather.
Uh-huh.
Water vapor being the number one greenhouse gas. For example, we've had various epochs. We've had the Great Ice Age. We had the Mini Ice Age 1, and then the second Mini Ice Age 2, and then we had the Little Ice Age. We just came out of, it started warming up after 1850. So Greenland was green at one time during the Roman warming period. England grew grapes during the Roman warming period as far north as Scotland. That's climate change. Was it caused by cow farts or human activity? No. Natural cycles. Volcanism, blocking the sun, cooling the earth. Those are the things that really affect things. The sun and its relationship with the water vapor and the atmosphere. The sun is primary, obviously. So when you block the sun with lots of like ash in the atmosphere from volcanoes, sulfur dioxide, etc. There was actually a year, I believe it was 1815, that they said there was a year without a summer. It was so bad, there was no summer for at least 1 year, a little bit into two. What happened? One little volcano popped. It's called Mount Tambora in Indonesia, right near the equator. Blanketed the earth with volcanic ash, blocking the sun. No growing periods. People were dying. Famine was increasing. Pestilence was everywhere. It was one of the worst times ever. Have your audience look up the year without a summer, Mount Tambora. And they'll see just one little volcano did that. And it was right near the equator, which was really significant for that reason. So when you look at geology, geology ties in very much so to the climate. For example, you know, you have the Cascade Range, Mount St. Helens, May 18th, 1980. It blew its top. That's what got me into geology, by the way, Mount St. Helens. I was fascinated with volcanism and tectonics and so forth, and so that's where I went into geology. And that was the major thing that happened in my lifetime that really got me stimulated in that direction.
That was a huge, huge, huge impact. Kurt, we have to take a really quick break, then we're going to come back.
Alrighty.
Our guest is Kurt Schrenker, and you are listening to We the People with just Aaron. That's it. No Bill. Bill's homesick. So that's why he's not saying anything. I do not have him, I do not have tape over his mouth. I haven't done anything to him. He's fine. Well, he's sick, but he's fine. You can find everything about the program, including the archives, how to sponsor, all those kinds of good things at wethepeopleradio.us. Yes, we do have a wealth of music available for shows on this sort of topic. Blind and New Science, what's that from, like the 70s maybe? 80s?
83, I think.
Probably.
No. Yeah, still good today. So, all right, Mount St. Helens happens, and you already sort of liked that topic.
Well, yeah, what happened was all this ash, as if you remember, it made it south. It made it all the way around the Earth, actually. Made it to Maine, and less than 3 days, and of course it darkened everything underneath it. So people were really seeing the sun being blocked. There were streetlights going on 24 hours a day underneath the cloud of ash that was blocking. And of course it got cold, too. But the thing was, when you have multiple volcanoes, Lassen, Shasta, you know, St. Helens, Rainier, Baker, you know, all these different ones in the Cascade Range and so forth, all going crazy. Now we've got a blanket of ash. So when volcanism was heavy in the past, and it has been at times, we can know that. We even Lassen is a very active volcano to this day. I'd love to, you know, study that one. I've actually studied quite a bit of Lassen, actually, over the years, because it does reflect a lot like what we see at St. Helens. Mount St. Helena here in Santa Rosa, California, where I'm from, St. Helena was a volcano that was twice as tall, lost 3,000 feet of summit elevation in just a series of a few eruptions about 3,500 years ago, making this whole area basically covered with rock, volcanic debris field that now we're living on top of, and that's why Sonoma County has such great wines. We got the great weather and the great soils, as it were, to give a good wine grape, for example.
Mm.
But anyway, I digress there a tad, but I had a plug-in for Santa Rosa and the wine country. The thing that I really extremely into at one time was glaciation. I still am. Glaciation. We have Meteora in Greece. We have, of course, glaciers all around the world. But Yosemite Valley was glaciated during the Great Ice Age. And those little areas, that was almost 2 miles of ice in Yosemite Valley. That's
wow.
A lot of ice.
That's
and
a lot
across
of ice.
The fluted plain, you know, all the way across, you know, you got down to Kentucky, into that area, all the way down from Michigan and all those areas, all that was ice during the Great Ice Age. We're seeing with the Great Lakes and all the different scratch zones and scrapings and everything else, we see that, what they call moraines and so forth, remnants of ices or ice age ice that formed these glaciers. So we have times where we have cold and we have warm. We have warming periods and cooling periods. And we have those that recorded in history, the Roman warming period, the medieval warming period, the Renaissance came. It was times were better historically under warming periods and cooling periods. When you had the Great Ice Age, we had people living in caves. We call them Neanderthals. They were human beings living in caves. They believed in life after death. They buried their dead. They did cave paintings, but life was hard. You couldn't grow anything. You had to, all your food came from meat. You know,
yeah.
If you found, you know, vegetables, it was a luck job there. You know, you didn't have farming. It was just wasn't happening all that much. Soon after that, that was a Great Ice Age. After that, we had a warming period and a cooling period, a warming period and a cooling period. And we're just coming out of the last ice age. It's called the Little Ice Age. Through the 1700s, it started warming up after 1850, they say. That's kind of the target date. You know, it's hard to fix it, you know. But the point is that we're on a warming trend. So now we're looking at this little itty-bitty time and saying it's all caused by cars. Wait a minute, what's the car problem? Oh, yeah, carbon dioxide.
Yeah, right.
Carbon dioxide. Oh, yeah, that's good for plants. Give me some data. Give me data points. Show me the proof. No, we're just going to give you assumptions and what we think. We don't even have to give you data points. There hasn't been any real papers, anything really substantial to give human-caused climate change even a leg to stand on any scientific level. But they say, oh, 93% of climate scientists agree. Hogwash. I read the paper. There's a guy named Cook out of Australia. He basically said, it's been like years since I read it, but I'll give you the gist of it. He was saying that what they did is they took about 12,000 articles in a span of 10 years. They didn't read the articles. They just looked at the abstracts. The abstracts give you the kind of the summary of the paper on climate change and ice age, anything to do with warming up the earth. Okay, any papers?
Sure.
97% of them, they say, Obama quote, he just tweeted it one day, 97% of climate scientists agree man-made global warming is real. Boom. And now the whole world bought into it, hook, line, and sinker, because it was unquestioned assumptions that Obama would give us the truth. Well, when you actually read the article, it said nothing of the sort. It was 97% of the third that have 97% of the, because it was basically broken down in thirds. The papers are broken down, and they say basically a third of them say yes, a third of them say no, and a third of them don't know. So of the ones that say climate change, 97% say it's human caused.
97%
say
they don't even know.
All the data, and they're ignoring papers that didn't fit the paradigm. So we get guys like Mann, the hockey stick.
Yeah.
We get him to do a paper, and it says, look at that. We have stasis and then a sharp rise in temperature. Hogwash again. He was shown to be a fraud. He ignored data, major data points that showed we have a mini ice age and a little ice age that would have been in that graph, but he took them all out because he wanted to see stasis. So he used what they call data that they got from a different direction. They didn't use the same data points like historical. They used tree rings to get the data. That's really reliable. And then so he was able to get the data he wanted to create the graph he wanted to create the extreme stasis with a sharp rise during the Industrial Revolution. See, it's all tied up, it's all correlated to climate change here with humans and their industrial revolution. So industry bad.
Right.
Stop eating meat, because, you know, flatulence from cows are causing climate change with the two molecules per million. Okay, that's another absurdity. They say, we've got to do something about these cars, we've got to make them this way, and so they're trying to make them cheaper, they're trying to make them lighter, they're trying to make them economical, and they're trying to do all these things. They're pushing electrical now, of course, with Teslas and different other cars. They're trying to manipulate us. And, you know, for example, this is something crazy, and you can check this out on your own, but the Biden administration did the Green New Deal, basically. It was actually the Green New Deal, just repackaged. They allotted, during Biden time, $8 billion to build car chargers for your average car. Not your Tesla chargers, because they're everywhere, but car chargers in various malls and places. $8 billion was allotted. In the 4 years, they built eight chargers. Eight. That's $1 billion per charger. I wonder where the rest of the money went.
Michigan?
You have to ask the question. You can't spend $8 billion. I mean, I'd love to spend $1 billion on something. I would have the most amazing house ever, right?
Yeah, if you could even spend it. I mean, could you imagine?
Yeah. But, these people were putting money in people's pockets everywhere to where they could.
But there never was a repercussion particularly for that, because we just have never, always use the term we loosely, have never been able to get around the corner of this not being a man-made problem and all of that. I mean, can you talk at all about kind of the motivation behind a lot of this? I mean, is that in your wheelhouse?
It's all over the wheelhouse.
Okay.
You know, the science, obviously, I can rock solid rest on the science.
Yeah,
problem, therefore you have a human solution. The human solution is basically socialism. Okay? That's where it's basically going to head.
Yeah, and that's what they're...
Never let a crisis go to waste. We got to create a crisis.
And that way
and
we can...
And that's the one to blame it on us, because, you know, we can have the hockey stick tell us, and Obama told us, and there you go.
Well,
non-scientist giving us science.
But, Kurt, didn't we have... Wasn't it global cooling in the 70s? I seem to remember
Absolutely.
That as a kid. We were all going to freeze to death, right?
Exactly.
And then...
The thing is, we have short memories, and we're really not too bright. we make decisions on assumptions and on emotion, and people are geared that way now. They just trust the science. It's like, wait a second, trust the science. What did they tell us about COVID? Oh, trust the science.
That blew up. Yeah, and what science? Because in what class did we ever? I mean, even if all you did was go through high school, you know, science was never. Someone said something, and then it was that way forever. That's it.
Well,
I mean, what happened to the whole hypothesis and, you know, all those good things?
Questioning science is science.
That's how that's how we invented things. That's how we solved problems. That's how we figured out the Earth wasn't flat. I mean, really, the whole time. Any idea? What's your thought on why these guys did? Were they just super well connected?
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, these guys that somehow they make some crazy assertion, and then I guess we'll have to do it on the backside of the news. But I'm curious how they became so powerful.
Yeah, okay. No worries.
We're chatting about climate change now. We've gone from Prop 50 to climate change like we were supposed to. Yay! And I have a fun song for you about glaciers. It's painful to listen to, but funny nonetheless. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I look at you now, see your temperature rising, while mighty glaciers weep. I look at you now, see your oceans are rising, while nations are lost in the deep. I don't know why nobody told you they stole and fooled you.
Now here we have two real pioneers embarking upon a new career, capitalizing on this global warming hype. Yeah, they're the ones that brought you the left-handed hammer and tried to market a recycled pamper. You could say the Gulliver brothers have always been the entrepreneurial type. But this next harebrained gullible venture could be earmarked as the major clincher as to whether or not they'll be living it up in their retirement age. They put all they had into one bankroll, bought a bunch of land down at the South Pole, eagerly awaiting the impending doom of climate change, thereby being in the catbird seat in the new Florida. And I'm all for working hard to keep this planet clean, but man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms.
A lot of us know that this is a, you know, really basically kind of a just a hoax. I mean, they've skewed enough data. There's enough stuff, you know, the $8 billion for 8 car chargers. There's been so much stuff because it turned into a massive policy thing almost, I don't know, it feels like almost immediately, but you've tracked it better than I have. How long did it take before it became a moral imperative, therefore a policy imperative?
Well, you know, what I always like to tell people is that, first of all, I believe in climate change more than anybody you know. You know, I am a climate change believer. I believe in climate change more than Al Gore and Bill Nye put together. Okay, together, those two are deniers compared to me. But I will always say on the offset of that, but I know the humans aren't causing it. See, they have to have humans causing it so that we can have a human or a political intervention to fix the problem. You know, never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
We got to create a big enough crisis, not just for America. How about the world? How about world-ending famine, global warming? Well, that's actually a good thing, but hey, let's not embrace the ice age yet, you know. That'll really bring problems if it really happens. And it could be another ice age because it's all based on volcanism. And you don't really have too much say when a volcano is going to go. You just find out and you get out of the way if you can. All right? That's all you can do.
Yeah, we don't get to stop that yet.
Yeah. So human-caused, i.e. your cars you're driving, emitting of just a trace amount of carbon dioxide compared to the oceans that emit carbon dioxide when they degas. Half the Earth's surface, basically, over half, it's pretty much, well, if you look at the side of the Earth when you look at the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you pretty much just see ocean. And as that ocean warms, it degasses. The warmer the oceans get, the more they degas. And then what happens is, the gas gets up there and it blocks, the clouds block the sun, and then it starts cooling. It kind of oscillates. They actually do, they actually call it the oscillation effect is the word that they actually use and refer to that.
Okay.
But this has always changed. The actual fact of the matter is climate is always changing. It always will change. There's nothing we can do to stop it. Now you can say, well, we can do modifications, i.e., you know, geoengineering. We could seed clouds and get lots of rain like they did in Vegas, like they did in Dubai a couple years ago, where they had flooding in the streets. They, oh, we did a little too much. You know, yeah, we can do stuff like that, but we're not going to have, global warming on a scale of any sort because of humans. You're going to have isolated things like cloud seeding and other sort of things using HARP, H-A-R-P. Certain things like that, and those things they're actually trying to you know, even bring about change. They say blame it on the earth or blame it on you. And once they blame you, now they can control you. It's your fault. Now we got to do something about emissions. All of us drive cars. Let's get a hold of people. Now we get a hold of the economy. Now we get a hold of the very thing that keeps the economy going, transportation, fuel, energy. Once we control energy, then we control, we got everyone by a death grip around their neck. It's like the word mortgage doesn't mean like I owe money to the bank. No, death, it means literally the word mortgage is death grip. They're putting you on an economic death grip, saying we can control where you live, how far you're able to drive. You're going to need carbon credits. Oh, wait a minute. We're going to have to do this. We're going to build these big, huge factories here that all they do is suck air and pull out carbon dioxide, spending billions of dollars across the nation. All these places are putting out these factories that actually suck air, and they contain and trap carbon dioxide. It is the most insane idea as possible. Imagine this. Imagine this. Imagine some genius, some amazing Nobel Prize winning, you know, physicists from Harvard and a team of guys from the Ivy League to say, we've discovered a way to take about 60% of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Fantastic, right? Great thing. We have less, you know, global warming now, right? No, we have the death of life. Life is gone. Everything dies. The net effect is no more plants, no more life. Plants have to be at the minimum 150 parts per million to even stay alive, not thrive. The more of it they have, the more they thrive. And then at that point, at 150, they start to die. So the net result of losing all that great carbon dioxide is the death of all things. What pollutant out there in the world, which EPA has actually identified, and they take charge of the term carbon dioxide and say it is now classified as a pollutant.
Yeah.
The very thing that keeps us alive is a pollutant. You imagine if you get rid of this pollutant and everything dies. Some pollutant, right? No, we want more of it. As a matter of fact, the founder of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore, if you look that up, Patrick Moore is the founder of Greenpeace, and he's been on a tirade saying we need more carbon dioxide. We are carbon poor, not carbon rich in our atmosphere. We are at the level of low end, not high end. The higher the end, like during the Roman warming period, there was more carbon dioxide because oceans were warming and degassing more carbon dioxide. Life thrived. Right now, they've actually say that the Earth is greening because we're coming out of that ice age. And it's getting more green as we're getting more carbon dioxide. As oceans degas and our little trace 4% of contribution is only doing one thing, giving plants a little more edge, just a little bit. We need lots more.
Well, also,
carbon dioxide is the enemy, but it's not. It's our friend, but they want to classify it as an enemy, control it, therefore controlling us. Now, why? It's economic imprisonment. They keep you on that treadmill. You go to work, you wake up, you do your bits, you do this, you pay your taxes, then you die. Boom. Recycle people. Just keep them in this little thing, this little loop, while we, the elite, will always stay above them. And that's only accomplished through socialism. So they actually ultimately want a one world government. That's why it's a global problem. They want a global currency, they want a global leader, they want to have basically a socialist communist worldview controlling us, and then the elite, let's say, the proletariat, will be the ones in charge.
Yeah, for our own good, of course. And before we leave, Dr. Patrick Moore, we interviewed him back in 2019, April of 2019, and if people would like to listen to some of that, totally worth doing. It's commercial free. Uninterrupted, free to listen, and if you just go to Enviro Craziness on the website at We the People Radio.
I already know his direction. That's great. That'd be a great one.
Yeah, we have him on there. And he, the thing that was, well, two things that were super interesting that really stuck out to me at the time was why he left Greenpeace, because I was I was fascinated on that. You know, like, why did you leave? You started this thing. You know, what made you leave? And the other thing was the deal with the reefs, the bleaching of the yeah. coral reefs. And he actually kind of yelled at us on that part. He did yell at us. I didn't have a chance to maybe put a disclaimer up that we didn't actually believe that. We were just asking him about it. he yelled at us about the coral reefs. But I have to tell you, do you know why he left? Do you know why he ditched out on Greenpeace?
Why is that?
It was awesome. He said, well, we saved the whales. You know, we formed to save the whales. And, you know, I was the only real scientist. And you know, it was a good project. It was well thought out, and it was necessary at the time. We did a good job. We did a lot of good work for the whales. And he said, then they came to me, and the next thing they wanted to do was ban chlorine. And he's like, wait, what? And they said, well, we have to ban chlorine. Like, that's our next campaign, like, banning chlorine. And even I knew chlorine's on the periodic table. I mean, chlorine's an element in our world. You can't ban something that's naturally occurring. And they thought, when he, you know, kind of went at him with that, they thought it came from a factory. They thought we made chlorine. And so he was like, he actually said it in the interview. He goes, yeah, I realized I was working with people who were intellectually at such a deficit that I wasn't able to get anything done, and I left. And then they told everybody that he was never part of it.
Well, you know, fake science survives on suppressing people's ability to get knowledge about it. In other words, censorship.
Yeah.
And on keeping people ignorant. So ignorance and censorship are the bread and butter now of science. You don't question. No, wait, we always question. We always look at the data. What do you think peer review is?
Yeah,
that's
right.
Called questioning, people.
Right.
Stop the lunacy.
Yeah, yeah, step away from the... So with the reefs, that was really interesting. Hit that again, because it's been a lot of years since we've talked about that. Please do.
Yeah, all right. Well, the Great Barrier Reef is the world's most amazing reef. I used to live in Australia. I know quite a few Australians, and love the people there. There was a time during the Great Ice Age when the Aborigines say, this is how far we walked. And it was right in the middle of the Great Barrier Reef. It was dry land during the Great Ice Age. Remember, most or a lot of water from the oceans were heaped up on land. Siberia, North America, you know, all the way down to Kentucky, ice sheets, all the way across the Fruited Plain. And that's how we get, you know, the glaciation and all the different cuts and, you know, the tectonic stuff that goes along with that too, and the volcanism that stimulated that from blocking the sun. Now, you see how it all ties in?
Yeah.
You know, you have the science of glaciation, climate change caused by volcanoes primarily, blocking the sun, affecting the climate of the earth, getting in a cold spell. Then you have to kind of come back and warm things up. So you go through these oscillations, and the Great Barrier Reef, like, again, was dry. Then after the Great Ice Age, a lot of water basically made it back in the oceans. We had land bridges. Now, Australia's landlocked. It was actually land bridges into Australia, too. Landlocked, the Great Barrier Reef is now ocean, and it's shallow enough to have a perfect depth for reefs, because a reef has to be at a certain depth. You can't have it above the water, and you can't have it too deep either, because you have to get sunlight down there. After 60 feet, 70 feet, you don't see much light. You see some. I mean, I was a scuba diver for years, still do. And, you know, the deeper you go, you have to get in these big bright lights to be able to see color, and the colors are amazing, but you can't see the color at all unless you have a light on it. By the way.
Yeah, and he talked about how it's organisms that live in the coral. The coral is white. It's white.
Yeah, they're little homes.
And
yeah.
And it's the, what is it?
It's calcium-based, but I was going to get to this guy named Peter Ridd.
Okay.
I'll repeat that name again. Peter Ridd. He is the world authority on the Great Barrier Reef.
Oh.
And he has been criticized and ridiculed for not carrying and not stating the, you know, repeating the narrative. He says the Great Barrier Reef is healthy. It goes through cycles. It goes through these cycles of bleaching. It's just a natural occurrence. Oh no, it's caused by humans. Wait, stop.
Oops.
And he has been, like, ostracized, thrown out of every, you know, science group because he won't toe the line.
Yeah.
But wait a minute, isn't he the world authority on the Great Barrier Reef? Yes. So shouldn't we talk to him about some of these things, the historical aspects and the scientific salinity and everything else? Yes. But wait, he doesn't give us the narrative we want. Get rid of him.
Off with his head. How do you spell his last name? R-I-D? Is it that?
R-I-D-D. Peter Ridd.
Okay.
Yeah, you can look
that
up on your little show there and maybe put online there. But he's been interviewed by a guy named Tom Nelson. I'll throw another name out there, Tom Nelson Podcast.
Okay.
If you are a junkie for this kind of information, he has interviewed some of the top people in the world. He's Harper, Lindzen, a gal, her name is, let me think for a second. I have to look it up. Anyway, she was in charge of Georgia Tech. She was the chairwoman in charge of Georgia Tech. She was fired because she wouldn't toe the line. She was a climate scientist, a real one, not just some guy like, you know, sideliner says, I just repeat what I'm told.
Sure.
You know, she actually was doing the science. Another lady, Corinne, let me go look these up real quick.
We've chatted with Dr. Judith Curry, too, a few times.
Curry, yes, Curry, that's her name, Judith Curry. You're on it.
And she's great. We've had her on a bunch of times. We have to take a really quick break. You can, if you want to reference those folks, you have a couple of minutes to do it.
Yeah.
And I'll adjust my microphone so I stop hitting it. And sorry for blowing your eardrums out there.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. So,
Judith Curry is top-of-the-line scientist, and they said, no more for you.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't, she wouldn't toe the party line, and even though she was a tremendous scientist, and they thought her work was excellent, well, now she's not excellent.
The problem was she questioned it.
Yeah.
Because she was going along with it for a while, and she says, you know, let me look into this a little more closely because it's getting to be kind of a hot topic.
Right.
And she says, there's nothing further from the truth than what they're saying.
She's like, hey, wait a second, this isn't real. Yeah, she had quite a career before they made her. Made her persona non grata.
Right.
And that's fairly common. So when you start seeing that, you know, that's always a little heads up. We'll be right back with our guest. And, are we good? Okay, we are good.
We're good.
And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
In one.
Seriously, dude.
There's a crisis on the planet. It's heated up almost a whole degree. It hasn't been this hot in a long time. Not since the 16th century, when there were no evil SUVs. Stop global warming. It's up to you. The Earth's been head out of the clouds.
Yeah, if my party's alright, uh-huh. Now don't talk to me about the polar bear. Don't talk to me about the ozone layer. Ain't so much of anything these days, even the air. They're running out of rhinos, what do I care? Let's hear it for the dolphin. Let's hear it for the trees. Ain't running out of nothing. In my deep freeze. It's casual entertainment. We ain't too free. And my party is alright. Uh-huh. Do what you please.
Running out of anything in my deep freeze. I love that song. I wonder if they got in trouble for that. It's an old one. I wonder if that was before you were, canceled for, going against the orthodoxy. Hey, so did you have other people for us that we should
I was going to, you know, you got Susan Crawford, choosing your archives. A guy named Richard Lindzen, he's a professor of atmospheric physics at MIT. Of course, he is saying there's no climate emergency. William Happer, he's at Princeton, and he was on the advisory boards, and he's like on the, he does a whole lot of things. He does most of his work on carbon dioxide. That's where I get a lot of my study and research and his tests and so forth. He has this little, like a meter reader thing. He reads the amount of carbon dioxide at a given time. And it varies. You know, if you're in a building for any length of time, carbon dioxide goes in because people are breathing, okay?
Yeah.
They even have these carbon dioxide meters that if it gets a little too high, you can get hypoxia. So they open up and allow fresh air from the outside to recirculate. And so these are some of the things that you see. So he's involved with that sort of stuff. There's Nobel Prize winners. But the one I want to talk about is a gal named Susan Crawford out of Canada. She's a zoologist. Her specialty...
So we all saw this old polar bear standing on this sort of frozen...
Your connection is too far away.
Yeah, let me do this real quick. I'm in my car, so
it made a
quantum leap into the system. I was.
Yeah, your car broke up with you. That's never good.
We don't do well.
All right, now we're back.
There we go.
Back in line. Susan Crawford, Canadian scientist, world authority again on polar bears, and we all saw the old polar bear that some guy took a picture of. That was dying. Now, you know, animals die from time to time. Matter of fact, people die every day. About, you know, basically 2.8 million people die in America every year, roughly. Probably a little bit more lately since we had the COVID vaccine. Actually, I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
It was pretty much static within 50,000 either way. And then COVID rolls around 2020. And by the way, it didn't even go up or down. It actually went down slightly from the average. Okay, so there was no pandemic, just FYI. It was all media-driven fear and number crunching that was done through manipulation, saying, okay, if you check this box, we'll give you money. The more boxes checked, the more cases we have, the more money we give out, the better numbers we have, and now we can keep the fear going, which is exactly what they're doing with climate change, controlling the narrative.
Yeah, there was
the narrative of what? Oh, climate change is killing polar bears. So we see this one polar bear. Guy's out there for ages looking for a real sorry-looking one, some old grandpa, probably a great-grandpa, and he's looking for a place to die. Well, they don't, like, go to the rest home and get hospice. They go off on some iceberg, and they lay there, and they die and become fish food or whatever other food.
Hey, what do you call it? What do you call a dead polar bear?
What do you call a dead polar bear?
Anything you want, he's dead.
Okay, got it, man. We'll call him fish food for now. But anyway, the thing is that this guy took this picture and created this whole narrative that it's because of man-made global warming, the polar bears are dying. And us as emotional creatures who don't think logically will just follow our emotions and believe the narrative. So Crawford actually chimed in and says, actually, no, they're actually thriving more than any other time because we actually have a melting of ice. We have more plant life in the water, which then gives more oxygen, which gives more food for the fish, which then provides more fish, which then provides more seals, which of course gives more food for guess who? Our friends, the polar bears. So actually, in reality, they were thriving, but that doesn't set the narrative right. We can't have a thriving ecosystem. We have to have a collapsing ecosystem, which is where Greta Thunberg, you know, a great scientist that everyone should probably read.
As long as you don't have to listen to her.
Well, no, how dare you say that?
Exactly.
You know, the great scientists that we got to listen to are, you know, Al Gore.
Yeah.
I mean, what's he known for? Basically making fear movies that were put in every single public school in the nation. You had to watch it at least twice, maybe three times in your career. Earth in the Balance and, you know, Inconvenient Truth and all these different things, right? You get Leonardo DiCaprio, amazing scientist, spending millions of his own dollars fighting climate change. You get Prince Henry, of course. Well, Prince Harry, I should say. You know, he's out there. Obama, he's fighting there, you know, Stop the climate change.
He's kind of lost his edge on the climate change, though. You don't hear much from Obama. I would be remiss if I didn't hearken back to, like, 2016. We had a guy named Jim Lee who was on the program back then a few times. And he was specifically going up against this hysterical, stuff with this geoengineering and all that, you know, we're all being sprayed like lab rats and we're all going to die and the trees in the Costco parking lot are all dead and blah, blah, blah. And the ozone layer's burning us to death. And this guy's like, look, it's all just fear porn. You get them hooked on it and then they can't walk away. And I was like, you know, that's probably the best characterization I've heard for this whole thing. The whole climate thing. It's just fear porn.
Yeah,
get them hooked on it, and then they can't walk away. And even when fact, you know, even like we see this, doesn't even have to be climate. We see this like with wolves. Obviously, they're not endangered. We have a lot of them, and more than even the agency, you know, the state agency would admit. And yet, can't even discuss taking them off the endangered species list because once they're on forever, and then they must be, you know, we must have more. Must have more. So I think polar bears hit that same thing. Everybody got sad about the polar bears. And
also, it's Christmas time, and we see polar bears drinking Coke and having a great life.
Oh, there's that. That's true. Forgot about that.
You know, because now they're endearing to us because, you know, they're the weighing up there, and they're doing their best to live in this cold place. Why live up there? Well, because they actually thrive pretty well when there's seals. They are eating high on the hog, and that's the whole thing. They're thriving. So Susan Crockford, by the way, is one that you can look up, and she lost her job because she didn't tote the narrative, you know, repeat the narrative.
Oh, she said polar bears weren't endangered, and therefore she had to be excommunicated?
Exactly.
Oh.
No, she's gone. She's excommunicated.
Oh. We lost a lot of good people. Just if we were just going to look at this one topic and make a... you know, a list of all the people that are now not contributing to the science, and how does you know, that's the crazy part is I think if people were really dispassionate about it and looked at it factually, that doesn't advance knowledge at all.
Well, you know, what we're seeing here is the fear porn. I think it's a drug that they're pumping into our schools, these kids. And I've seen kids, and I taught school for years. Kids, I know a lot of kids right now who says, I'm never going to have kids. Why? Oh, because overpopulation, we're going to kill ourselves. Is this another gas, another carbon dioxide producer? We got to do something about this, you know? So they're anti-children, they're anti-family, they're pretty much saying, you know, just live for now because tomorrow we die. Almost like Epicureanism. But, you know, you got this kids living in fear, though, knowing that this world's going to end soon, and it's all because of our poison that we're putting into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
I oftentimes run into people that will also equate carbon dioxide with, you know, basically poison gas or garbage. They say, oh, wait, we got all these chemicals, we got all this, you know, overflowing whatever from our landfills. You know, we have microplastics and this and that. It's like different animal. Let's keep them separate. Carbon dioxide doesn't drive climate, but you're asserting that this. Show me the study that actually shows it actually drives climate. It doesn't. There's no study because there's no actual factual evidence that even supports such a notion, but it doesn't matter because we got people to believe it without question. That fear drives them to doing stupid things.
Is it still
getting a jab?
Oh, getting a job?
No, jab. Getting the COVID.
Oh, jab. Yeah.
People got that out of fear.
Yeah.
Or if they don't get it, they're going to give someone else the COVID. So you better do it if you love your grandmother.
Right. They did a really good, I'll have to find it and I'll put it on the page for today, but there was an amazing, about 20-minute video called The Killing of the Mind, how mass psychosis takes over an entire population. And,
awesome. Yeah, must be a great study.
It was on YouTube. It is on YouTube. It's like the second most looked at thing that I ever referenced because it came out in 2021. It was during the whole COVID thing when people really, truly had lost their minds. I mean, they had lost their ability to reason. How about that? To be more accurate.
People, mass formation psychosis, you no longer think.
And that's what this is. Mass psychosis. How an entire population becomes mentally ill. And it was done by the Academy of Ideas, and it's one of those that is, they draw on like a cartoon board. It's really good. I'll put it on there because it's still incredibly appropriate today. And I really liked it because the answer to that was by making fun of the people who were pushing the narrative. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Well, now you're in my wheelhouse. So we save ourselves from that by mocking them. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Huh, that's fantastic.
I'll have to send you a few things later on.
Yes,
on
please.
The text. I will
add those because conversation with most people, they'll say, yeah, you know, I kind of bought into that for a while, but it seems like that's not really a thing. However, we are ensnared by the policy now that has us by the throat, you know, so now can't rebuild your house for the same price you used to, not just the cost of materials, but all of the policy that goes with it and all of the climate change stuff. So it turned out to be a big moneymaker, honestly, for a lot of folks.
That's why I refer to the climate change controversy not as a hoax as much as a scam.
Yeah.
It's a foundation for the scam that they're putting onto the American people and onto the world with the movement of money. Who controls the purse strings? Oh, we got to set these car charges up. Okay, we're going to get those going. Okay, so there's $8 billion we'll allocate. Good. Let's see if that can get done. You know, 3 years later, they got 8 stations going right now. That's it. 8.
Yeah.
That's insanity.
Yeah, and that makes no sense. Well, and look at just even the things that have to be included in an automobile because of the climate change stuff.
Yeah.
Tell me this: are you seeing that fade out of? I don't know if we can necessarily quantify it on a policy level, but do you see people kind of stepping away from that, or are they digging in?
I see people that the average person, it's not the top of mind thing. You know, kids, I think they keep it in the schools. It's kind of in top of mind for them. But they don't know why. They just are kept in fear. But
yeah.
I think your average person that I talk to, because I talk to people every day, you know, and I find a lot of them it's not their main concern. It's kind of like they're realizing it. And you know, I've talked to thousands of people about climate change, you know, in lecture form, in radio form, and one-on-one, and in groups, small groups. And it's a kind of an ongoing study. And I'm convinced that the whole climate change scam survives on they depend on your ignorance of the issues and of the science itself. Once they can keep you in the dark and feed you, I call it the mushroom diet.
I was just going to say, it's the mushroom diet.
They keep you in the dark and they feed you lots of manure.
Yeah. Well, and if you, depending on the circles you travel in, if you pipe up against it, then, you know, you're a heretic and it's still the same. We still treat heretics the same, you know. They are they're not fit for polite society. So I would imagine in a lot of circles, in a lot of geographic areas too. I would imagine in your area, climate change alarmism is alive and well.
It is. I've gone to some, you know, county meetings, you know, with the city councils and so forth, and I pipe in for my like 2-3 minutes, whatever they give me.
Uh huh.
And then, you know, when I try to bring in illustrations to show them, I bring in a big, huge, it's actually about 2 kilos of pennies, 2,500 of them in a box. And I say, now, see this box of pennies? I drop it there on the counter, go thud, and it's a big, huge thing. And then I say, now, let's imagine this to be all the atmosphere in the world. This penny right here, it's all the carbon dioxide, if that's all the atmosphere. And they look at that and go, hmm. And I say, and of that penny, we provide a little bit of it. It's just a 4% of that penny.
Of the one penny.
Of the one penny. So do you really think that that 4% is driving that whole 2-pound pile of pennies? Of course not. That would be thermodynamic nonsense. It's absurdity to the highest. And to double down on it just shows me that you're committed to nonsense, not committed to science. At least hear me out. At least think it through. At least question for a moment, because perhaps you or I could be wrong. And until you come to that point, you're never going to question.
Yeah. Yeah. Shutting down the debate. That's how we did it. That's how we did it with COVID. You know, if you didn't want to wear a mask, you just hated humanity. And it's like, wait a second. You know, it was very well explained that didn't do what they said it did. But, you know, a lot of folks weren't willing to kind of fly in the face of that, even though maybe they didn't believe, but they didn't want to be singled out. And I think we're at a point where, honestly, being singled out's okay. I think we're good with that.
I've gotten used to it, so I'm not in that fear category.
Me too.
They've done some experiments where they put everyone in a room, and everyone's in on it, but the one person they're watching. And then they show pictures, and they say, which one's bigger? And they all point to the one that's just a shade smaller and wrong. And the other one is right, and the guy goes, oh, yeah, I picked that one's bigger. But they all pick the wrong one on purpose.
To see if he'll cave.
And then after about three rounds, the guy's picking with everyone else the wrong one. Now, there you go.
No.
You just go along with the right. You know, here's the thing. With getting back to our 19 or 2020 mess that we found ourselves in, I was overseas living in Australia at the time. And I, of course, being a kind of a guy likes to research, I researched the coronavirus. Turns out that Pierre Bright Institute owns the patent to the coronavirus. Now, how do you own a patent to a virus? You have to genetically modify it.
Right.
Well, it's not really a genetically modified organism, because it's not an organism. It's actually a virus, which is much smaller than an organism. It's just it's a package of basically RNA. And so what happens is that little package goes, it's called messenger RNA. It goes into your body and it starts making more of that virus, and that's how you get it, right? The only way to fight it is with an antivirus or becoming immune by creating antibodies. So these antibodies identify the virus, and then it says, okay, now we got you, we kill you off, and we win. Now, a real vaccine gives you a weakened version. Remember, it's not alive, it's dead, it's not even...
Yeah.
It's nothing alive there. So you have to do what they call gain of function to get the patent on it. But my point is that the body has to identify it, then to create more antibodies to fight it. But the mRNA vaccine did none of those things, but it injected in your body messenger RNA. So now you are now, by default, a GMO. You've been genetically modified through fear of a virus that was augmented, gain of function, and released into society, and then the media just spread the news like it was like the end of the world. We got to do something. It's a crisis. You know, never let a crisis go to waste. This way we get rid of Trump. We get rid of the mail-in ballots. We're going to get 81 million votes for Biden, so no one's going to ever beat Biden, ever. I mean, I think Obama got like 69. That was the most ever.
Yeah.
And then Biden gets 81. It's like, whoa, he didn't even campaign. He was hiding in a bunker.
Yeah, that seems legit.
Everything about it was a scam.
Yeah.
But you know what? See, the media is driving this narrative. And tell the media, the mainstream media is the enemy of the people. I'm convinced of that.
And I think people are kind of figuring that out, like with the death of MSDNC and all that. I mean, you can see some of it shifting. We have to take a really quick break here and then come back to for the top of the hour with our guest, Kurt Stryker. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
thought we'd back to back the crazy songs. Seemed like it was overdue. Overdue on this topic. Oh my goodness. All right,
there's so much.
I know, it just there is so much.
Let me throw out some things that for your audience to kind of consider, and I'll touch base back on water vapor being a greenhouse gas and the deserts and so forth, because I didn't really finish that point, but I'll just say this much. You know, climate change is a real phenomenon. It does change. I believe in climate change more than anybody you know, like I said. Carbon dioxide is crucial and necessary for life on Earth. Carbon dioxide is not a pollutant, as the EPA wants to take control of it. As a matter of fact, carbon dioxide invigorates the biosphere and therefore increases food production. I mean, that's why greenhouses, like I say, use carbon dioxide to get a bigger crop faster with less water, because the stomata don't have to stay open so long, losing water through transpiration. They absorb the carbon dioxide, and they make the food quickly, and it's much more efficient. It's an amazing, invigorating thing for the biosphere. You know, the human contribution is 4%, which breaks down to about 16 parts. So 16 molecules of carbon dioxide for every million parts of atmosphere. That's a huge disparity of thermodynamicness there. You look at that and you think, there's no way it can affect it. Of course not. No one would even think that, especially when you realize the nature of carbon dioxide. You know, it holds heat for seconds only when the sun is on it. Remember the Sahara Desert and the eclipse thing I mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sahara Desert at night, if you go to Sahara Desert during the day, you're going to be over 100 degrees. You'll probably end up, you know, just barely surviving if you get some shade and a little bit of water. But if you don't have proper shelter that night, you would die from basic exposure there by hypothermia, because it gets down to about 25 degrees Fahrenheit, which is below freezing, obviously, at night. And why is that? Because there's no water vapor to hold the heat. Now, if you're in Hawaii or in Hilo or Kona or Maui, or anywhere on the equator, there's lots of water vapor, lots of humidity to hold the heat all night. You can spend the night without even wearing any covers. Just a pillow looking up at the beautiful, you know, palm trees and the stars. So, climate change caused by carbon dioxide, absurd. As a matter of fact, like I say, the main job of carbon dioxide is to give life and reinvigorate the plant life. So, really, carbon dioxide only holds heat for a few seconds. After the sun goes down, it's gone. So it's not even a very good greenhouse gas at that. Carbon dioxide is really not the Earth's thermostat. It's not the control knob of the climate.
Yeah, that is how they pitch it all the time, though. It's like turn the knob up and down.
Yeah, it goes up and down respectively. No, it's not a thermostat whatsoever. It's more of a thermometer. When the temperature goes up naturally, we get more carbon dioxide as a result as oceans degas. As life flourishes, we get more carbon dioxide. As it warms, we get life flourishing. We get more carbon dioxide, and life is good. So a lot of things like that. And by the way, carbon dioxide is heavy. You know, it's 1.5 times heavier than the atmosphere itself. So you get all these different gases out there. Helium, of course, goes up, right? You see it with helium balloons. Hydrogen goes up. But carbon dioxide goes down. Now, God in his infinite wisdom, of course, made plants on the ground, and they need what? Carbon dioxide. So it needs to stay down. Imagine if it was lighter, it would just be going up. The only trees that can survive would be super, super, super tall, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Right?
That's why we have a tree line around different mountain ranges. Life, plants cannot survive at this level. Why? It's not oxygen, it's carbon dioxide. It's not enough of it. So,
I never really thought about that. That's a good point.
Climate is a dynamic and highly complex study. It's not just turn the knob of, we got 500 parts or 50 parts per million more than, they say 350 is optimal. Well, show me the data. They can't. Right? It's just they're dogmatically asserting these so-called facts, which are not even facts whatsoever. They're just brazen lies, in my opinion. It's basically climate change scam uses fear and ignorance to control us, move money, and of course, by moving money and controlling us, gain power. Man-made global warming hoax survives because of censorship of real empirical science. Keep them in the dark, keep them, feed them like crap, and bingo, you're going to keep the mushroom diet, keep that thing going. Man-made climate change is a scam, is exposed by empirical science, like thermodynamics, the firmly established laws of physics. That's what climate is. It's thermodynamics, moving heat, transferring heat, and so forth. Sun primarily, and then the water vapor being the number one greenhouse gas. Carbon dioxide, not even a player. And lastly, I would say that the fallacies that you run into, used by climate alarmists, I would call it the ad hominem, is one of the best. Attack the arguer, not the argument, right? They
yeah.
appeal to emotion. Oh, wait, people are dying if you don't do this. It's all they dogmatically assert this appeal to emotion or appeal to authority. Everyone says it. 97% appeal to authority. Or they throw a red herring out there saying climate change is equivocation to, like, pollution. A red herring out there or a slippery slope. If we don't do something now, it's going to get far worse, and this is a point of no return. Or I like the argumentum, so to speak, ad populum. Everyone else believes it, Why can't you, right? Everyone else got the jab. Why not you, And I guess in closing, I'd like to encourage the audience to look up Tom Nelson podcast. He's interviewed all those people, Crockford, Ridd, all these guys that I mentioned before. Susan has been in there a number of times herself, who he interviewed there. Tom Nelson podcast
and
on YouTube.
I listed that on here.
He interviewed me, and I gave that to you so you can actually find the website.
Yep.
So it's not just watch me, but watch other people. If you're a real nerd in this stuff and want to really gain knowledge, he's interviewed hundreds of real, live, actual scientists. I'm more of a popularizer. I'm more of a guy who takes the knowledge that I study and make it, I laymanize. I give it to the layman so they can understand it, as opposed to some guys who are really into technical stuff. I like to take the technical, but I like to break it down to what's it really saying and how does this affect me and how can I convey this knowledge. And so what you get with me is a popularist way or a popularizer way of getting the knowledge to the people. I call it laymanizing or bringing it down to about a fifth or sixth grade level so even a young person can understand it.
Well, the part of it, too, is that it makes people who have questioned this not feel so out of step. Because if you're not a scientist, and let's face it, who's got time to go and do that for the most part? So then
right.
they feel like, well, they are silenced just because they can't hold their own in a debate. So hopefully this gives people at least some bite-sized knowledge. Like I think I told you when we were on the phone, Leighton Stewart was the first guy we interviewed on this topic back in 2014, and he had said, ambient air is about 400 parts per million carbon. If somebody was to drop on the ground and they did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, they are blowing into them 40,000 parts per million, and I was so grateful the math was so tidy. So you go from 400 parts per million to 40,000 parts per million of carbon, he goes, why don't they all die? And right. here it is 11 years later, and I'm still like, I don't know. And when you ask the true believers about that, because I have done that many times, they have no response for that other than the response I routinely get is, it's different. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound very scientific.
Okay, explain to me how it's different.
I know.
Just do the old Socratic thing.
Yeah, and they can't.
They never can. Their own corner of logic.
Yeah, they never can. It always blows up. So that, for me, has been a terrific tool the last 11 years. We have to run away. And thank you so much for coming on with us, Kurt Stryker. You can find us.
I'm so glad I looked at my phone when I did.
I am too, because I
was walking that church. I was talking to a friend of mine, and I was talking about some issues that were important.
I was going to have to drive to Santa Rosa and, burn your house down or something. But you guys already had
I'll come up there. We'll do one live in the studio.
There you go. All right. We will see you on another week. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore.
Another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Free advertisement of the day?
Yeah.
What are we into?
I don't know. What are you into?
Four Winds Jewelers. They've been great. And I saw Carl Bott from the station in there. Apparently they've been advertisers since the station opened. Huh, who knew? And I love them. They fix all my watches. If you have any old watches, especially mechanical, wind watches, Jim over there does all the fixing. And if you need your rings tipped or sized or any of that stuff, they do all the work in-house, and they do an excellent job, and the pricing is terrific. So that's Four Winds Jewelers on Hilltop Drive. Can't miss them. And so let's see. Let's do some tiny bit of housekeeping. The archives. The archives, moved them, actually, because we had too many years. Goes back 15 years. So I scooted them all over to make room for the incoming 2026. And just so you know, they are free to access, free to listen to. They're just MP3 files. We hope you make use of them. I don't have everything grouped by category, but categories where I had enough shows to put them all on one page. Wolves, pot, transgender stuff, Klamath, China, environmentalism. God knows there's plenty there. Shows with veteran focus, South Africa. I've got a ton of shows on South Africa. Islam, and then all the government and national security. I'll probably add this one. I don't know if I should add it to Enviro Craziness or government and national security. I think I'll add it to both pages.
You should.
So today we're, it's funny. I've run into a couple people who have heard of this issue, but mind-blowingly, probably 95% of the public is completely unaware.
Anybody that's heard about
that there is a looming gas crisis in California. So today we have with us in studio Mike Ariza, and then on a conference call we have Professor Michael Miché and Assemblyman Stan Ellis. So I have listed all of their bios and all of those things. Today is December 28th, 2025. And we hope you had a Merry Christmas, by the way. And unfortunately, we're going to ruin your new year before it even starts.
We're going to give you something to look forward to.
Oops. Yeah, sorry about that. Should have done something cheerful. So Mike was born in Fairfield, beautiful downtown metropolitan Fairfield, I'm sure, at that time.
Raised in Vacaville, went to Vacaville High School. He was in the Navy, so shout out to you on the Navy service. Thank you for that. And you worked, I'm just going to summarize, you were at Chevron Oil Refinery, you were at Exxon Valero at the Benicia Refinery for a long time, and Flying J Refinery in Bakersfield, and now you're at California State Chico.
CSU Chico.
Professor Miche is the Associate Professor of Practice of Management and Organization. He's widely sought for his independent and objective perspective, exceptional consulting acumen. That's what we're tapping into today, his consulting acumen, boardroom skills, and direct Socratic data-driven client-centric style. Sure, say that really fast. Of addressing highly complex and critical strategic, organizational, operational, and positioning issues, which obviously this is all of those things. He's been a member of the USC faculty since 1997, and he coordinates the USC's Marshall Management Consulting undergraduate and graduate curricula programs. I have his CV on there as a PDF if you would like to peruse. It's really pretty interesting. And then Assemblyman Stan Ellis. He is a farmer, local businessman, and community member with deep roots in the Central Valley. Grew up on a hog farm in South Dakota and worked to put himself through college at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. And he graduated with a degree in mathematics, settled in Kern County, and has an extensive entrepreneurial career where he wandered into politics somehow.
Oops.
Discovered the joys of the California legislature. We'll leave that for another show. Haven't we all blundered into that? Not as deeply as poor Stan. So, now that I've kind of laid out the cast of characters, I guess we should identify our voices, huh? So tell us something. Mike, where would you like to start? We'll go through where everybody wants to make sure we don't miss something.
Well, where to start? This has been going on for a while. I took interest in it when I heard that Valero was shutting down. So I'm farm myself and work at the university. It didn't really catch my attention until I heard Valero was shutting down. Valero is the most efficient refinery in the state.
And they supply a lot of California's supply.
Yeah, 10 to 11% of the gasoline, and they make another 12 to 14,000 barrels a day of jet fuel and diesel. And when they go down, we're going to lose about 10% of our supply. We're already, right now, with Phillips 66 is down, Marathon, Refinery Martinez, they're on 17,000 barrels a day of renewable diesel, but the 170,000 barrels a day of crude oil they used to bring in is shut down. So all the gasoline, all the jet fuel, the propane they make, it's gone. Rodeo Refinery converted over to renewable diesel. They're at rates of around 45,000 barrels a day of renewable diesel, but they also their gasoline, the jet fuel, everything they made, that's all gone. So with those two refineries down, we've lost 18 to 20% of the 38 million gallons a day that California still consumes of gasoline. And then Phillips 66 shut down on October 17th. They're in the final stages of that, so that's another 8 to 9%. And then Valero, originally they were going to shut down in April, but they're going to go ahead and apparently shut down in January as they canceled their crude oil contracts over 2 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So the state tried to get them to stay open, and they basically told the state, no, thank you, we're out of here. Valero makes about 10 to 11% of the gasoline that's coming into the state. So the total, with Valero going down, basically 40% of our gasoline jet and a huge percentage of our jet fuel and diesel is going to be coming from Singapore, South Korea, and from India.
And we can't import that because California has their own blend. Is that right?
Hold on, boys. We're jumping ahead.
Oh.
We need to identify the voices of everyone so that we can actually have a conversation and people will know who they are, because we don't know what they sound like either. But now that we've laid out some ugly math, let's bring in Professor Miche, who has 43 years of global management consulting experience, and in 43 years, I'm sure he's going to give this all an F. If we stick with the school theme, I think probably Gavin Newsom gets an F, yes?
Well, Gavin's grades aren't very good. This is Professor Mache, and thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be with you today. It's a great way to start, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following this industry since 1973, when I was an undergraduate. So I got into energy economics during the energy crisis of 73 with the Arab nations' embargo of U.S. oil supplies to the United States, and just began studying it. I mean, it was just a great industry to study. And then, of course, I started my career on Wall Street and then went to KPMG, became a partner, and then ultimately ended up at USC when I retired from the partnership. So it's been a lifelong study of mine. I love the industry. I love the economics of the industry. It's really fascinating to me. And I think if there will be a textbook written on this, and it'll be called All the Wrong Moves made by California and the legislature, and in particular our current governor. You know, when you look at some of the statistics, and we'll get into those when you're ready, they're pretty dismal, and they could have been entirely avoided, okay? But nonetheless, we are where we're at, and I'll let my good friend Assemblyman Ellis take over from here.
Yeah, we mentioned the California legislature. Cue Stan Ellis. So, Assemblyman Ellis, how much fun are you having? Uh-oh, he's in the cone of silence.
I don't know that he's on the phone.
Oh.
You might want to...
Well, he's having so much fun, he's not on the phone.
We said California legislature, and he's like, oh, this must not be for me. I better get out of here. Oh, my God.
Called the wrong number.
Yeah, Mike's going to...
I'm sure we'll get him.
Yeah, Mike's going to text him. So tell me this. When you say that this is totally preventable, and you've been looking at it since I was 12, have we teetered this close?
Really making me feel bad.
Yeah, but at least I was born. At least I was born then. You know, it's when they say, you know, 30 years ago, and they look at you with that deer in the headlights, you're like, oh, my God, you're right. I was born way before that. So when you say it was avoidable, avoidable recently or avoidable a long time ago? Like how long have we been marching toward the cliff?
Been marching toward the cliff for quite a while. When you began to see these refineries, we had over 40 of them at one time, right? Began to decline, and then somewhere around 2005. Is when we shifted from being more in-state production to being more reliant on imports. So we were fairly consistent in our production, in our dependency on in-state production all the way up until about 2005-ish or so. And then it switched and we began more dependency on imports, particularly from Saudi Arabia at that time. And, which was our number one producer and our number one supplier of oil for a long, long time. And so we saw ourselves becoming more dependent on the imports from these foreign nations. At the same time, the population was increasing, the number of motor vehicles was increasing, and the number of refineries were decreasing. So, it became somewhat of alarming to us as 15, 20 years ago. But it really began sort of crystallizing in 2015, and then again in 2019, which are pretty significant years when you look at the history of oil and gasoline in our state. And so in 2019, I think a few of the alarms went off, but the legislature and the governor dismissed them. And then I know in 2022, some more alarms went off among the producers. They actually contacted the government and said, look, you know, this could be a very difficult situation moving forward. And in 2023, I personally informed the state legislature via a Senate hearing that we needed more production. So a lot of this was avoidable, and then we started seeing more and more harsh regulations being superimposed on the industry. So, things like that were happening.
Sure. So you're saying that the Saudi Arabia imports, that was just crude, or was that refined fuels?
Okay, it was crude.
Okay.
We didn't really start importing a lot of refined fuels until, say, the last 10 years, the increases of refined product has started to increase. And now, for 2025, they're at an all-time 20-year high. We've imported more gasoline from foreign sources in 2025 than we've had since, I think, 2004. So, and there's no abatement of that on the horizon. So we can, you know, the only plan that the CEC has come forward with is importing more gasoline. That's it. They have nothing else to offer, and they haven't offered anything else to the people of California. And so they said, all right, we're going to increase more. Imports will increase. Yeah, port congestion will increase. Yeah, emissions will increase, and the price will increase. That's all we have to offer.
But what could go wrong?
So what could go wrong?
Right, what else?
You know, what could go wrong when we have 3 to 5 times more tankers on the Pacific Ocean coming to California in 2026 than you've had in 2024? You know, what could go wrong? So, you know, these are some of the issues we're going to look at, and we'll be happy to discuss these as we move forward.
Okay. And I heard a ding and a little bit of static. Sounds a wee bit like wind. So maybe Stan has blown in to join us.
Hi, everyone. This is Stan Ellis. How are you guys?
Hi, Stan. We joked about the California legislature trying to introduce you, and you weren't there. We're like, oh, no, they got him.
They got the stand.
we said California legislature, and then the sucking sound began.
Sounds like the assembly, frankly.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks for having me on the show, you guys.
Yes.
I'm traveling, so if I happen to lose you, I'll call back in.
No sweat. The beauty of conference call lines, right? They're always there for you.
Yes, ma'am.
And my name is Aaron, so just so you have some voices to go with.
Yeah.
Bill, say something.
Hi, Aaron.
Hello, Stan. Glad you made it.
So you've been watching this for how long?
Well, Michael Mish, Dr. Mish, and myself had met on a show, and he was so knowledgeable and he's been watching it for a lot longer than I have. And then this is about probably six months ago. And then we developed a relationship. And then Mike Ariza came to my office when I was in the state legislature and had done a really good job of summarizing the refinery end of it. I broke out in the oil field in 1975, so I have 50 years of experience in drilling, production, upstream and downstream. So the three of us had made a pretty good combination, and we came up with this. Looking at where we're going with our oil and gas production and our refining capacity, it was pretty simple to see that it's actually it is a risk to national security, and we really got worried. So we wrote a paper, and the professor did an incredible job, and so then here we are. 6 months later, trying to get the word out, and look, it's really a matter of national security, and I'm really worried. When you have Valero shutting down, and Travis Air Force Base gets 100% of its fuel, a jet fuel from Valero, where's that going to come from? And then all of a sudden, you look at the 40 some bases we have in California, with you know, which includes obviously. Air Force and China Lake and the other arms of the military, we have 40-some bases. And then we have Nevada, and part we're supplying. So what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden, and of course Russia knows this and China knows this. When they want to put a hurt on this, they drop a couple of those ships out, and guess what? We're in a gas crisis.
Yeah.
Not just for the public, but for the military. And that's my concern.
We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's start with Stan, because I'd like to hear we'll give you 2 minutes to maybe switch to decaf, because I'd like to know what the legislature, what the other folks in the legislature are saying when you're when you're bringing this up, because I think I already know the answer, but we'll all switch to decaf. Yeah. Gonna take a really quick break. We have Mike Ariza here, who has been in the refinery business for a long time. We have Professor Michael Miche from USC, and we have Assemblyman Stan Ellis with us from the California Legislature. So just that's our cast of characters today, and we're talking about the looming crisis in California with our refinery shutting down, which should alarm everyone, even if you don't live here. So we're going to come right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm going to do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm going to do bad things, you won't see it coming. Watch your step, I've been thinking of doing bad things to you.
It's about the best setup I got for you, Stan.
Yes.
Blame. So what's the response of your colleagues in the legislature when you bring up this topic?
Well, so there are 20 Republicans and 60 Democrats, and unfortunately the Democrats, and when I bring it up offline, they agree, but and I'm on the Natural Resources Committee, and there are bills that try to come forth that want to penalize oil companies for emissions, and we put out the cleanest.
The cone of silence is captured.
Very few. I'm sorry.
You broke up there, Stan. Go ahead and repeat what you were saying.
Yeah. So anyway, we put out the cleanest oil and gas in the world. And what's happening is that the green agenda and greenhouse gases emissions that the Democrats have put forth have made it appear that oil and gas is dirty. However, if that's the case, then why do we make 6,000 products from oil and gas and oil and gas derivatives? So the green agenda has ruined the oil and gas industry in California. And I'm the first one to say that we're going to run out of oil and gas for some future generation. Why wouldn't we, instead of spending $1 billion on high-speed rail, put it into fusion and put it into other alternative, you know, wind and solar a little piece, but fusion and fission and micronuclear are the real answers long-term. Mm-hmm. But until we get there, we need oil and gas. And so there's just no common sense. There's not a common sense transition. And to answer your question, the legislators, the Democratic legislators really don't get it, and they don't care to get it because they fall under Newsom's agenda, and his agenda is greenhouse gas, unfortunately.
Okay. So swing over to Professor Miche. So you've been watching this since 1974. So the fact that they're not getting it doesn't mean the results aren't going to happen.
Well,
to the state.
I mean, so let's look at some data, okay? Just make it as simple as we can. So at one time, California was the world's leading producer and exporter of petroleum.
Wow.
We were number one in the world. Now, that was a long time ago, right? Even before I started following this industry. And we have the fifth largest oil reserves in the United States. So, the petroleum industry, if you really sort of think about California, you have, the gold rush, and then the next rush was the black gold rush, which was the oil rush, which began in around 1869 and went all the way into, you know, the 20th century. So, petroleum played a huge part in the economic development of California. Now, the petroleum industry itself represents about 8% of the California GDP, but it's the first 8%. As Stan mentioned, you have petroleum in 6,000 products. If you have an EV, which is great, you're driving down the road on asphalt that's made from petroleum. By the way, your tires are made from petroleum, and your EV has about 4 or 5 quarts of oil in it to lubricate the parts that are moving. So, it's one of these products that is essential to any modern economy. So, we had this very significant and dominant position for years and years and years. And at one time, we had 40 refineries in the state, and now we're going to be down to 7. And probably by the end of 2027, probably down to 6. So we're looking at a decline. And some of the statistics that Mike Ariza mentioned, to put it more in sort of consumer terms, we're losing somewhere between 6.2 and 9.1 million gallons of gasoline a day in in-state production. That's how much our production is falling by a day. And so the question is, where is the state going to make that up? And the only answer that they have is, well, through imports. Great. They'll tell you that, but they won't tell you what the price effect of that will be. So in all instances, we're looking at price increases and the potential of supply shortages because, as Stan mentioned, you're going to have 3 to 5 times more tankers coming across the Pacific Ocean. Anything can happen. A typhoon, labor disputes, geopolitical events. Anything.
Mm-hmm. Shuts off the supply.
To disrupt that supply.
Yeah.
And by the way, we run on about a 14-day supply in the state. That's what we run on. Now, the statistics will tell you that
say that again? We have about 14 days.
Spare supply.
Days of supply, okay, in the state.
Oh, that's terrific.
Did anyone? Yeah, that's 14 days. That's it, though.
Yeah.
That's all you got. Okay. Now, what happens is when it hits around 12 to 13 days, it's almost like a hockey stick in terms of the bend in the curve. It literally goes like 80 degrees straight up in price. So at around 12 to 13 days supply, that price is going to increase by at least $1 to $1.50 a gallon. So that's how tight supply is, and that's how fragile this inbound supply system will be. And that has implications for the California consumer, and it has broader implications for the following. A, Arizona. They get about 48% of their gas comes from California, slightly less now.
Wow.
Nevada, totally messed up. Over 80% of their fuel comes from California.
Oh, shoot.
And as Stan and Mike and I, we tried to bring out in our study, not only are they affected, this California contagion effect will propagate on out into national security. And so, we have a significant vulnerability that's being created by the loss of these refineries. And I might add, the loss of the North-South pipeline, which is generally called the Crimson Pipeline, which is collapsing as we speak. So these are some of these profound implications of these policies. And what we tried to do in our study is just simply bring them forward factually. There's no real political agenda other than here's the numbers. And the numbers really aren't looking very good, and the numbers don't lie.
Now, you said there was roughly, what, six or seven refineries left in California. With the rest of these going out, are those refineries able to increase capacity, or are they kind of maxed out?
Well, Mike, I'll give the first answer, and Mike will give you the micro answer to that. I'll backfill it. They're pretty much maxed out. You can't run a refinery at 100% capacity. We all know that. The physics do not allow that. So when a refinery is running, say, between 88, 87, say, to 92, that's a really good sweet spot for the utilization. They don't really have a lot of upside on that because of the physics involved and safety and just the chemical processes involved in that refinery. So we're tapped out. Now we can change the mix. It's what do you want? If you want more gasoline, then I'm going to produce less jet fuel and less diesel fuel. If I want more jet fuel, then I have to produce less diesel fuel and less gasoline. So the refiners, as a result of the policies, are really boxed into a corner. And so, like any refiner, they try to optimize their product mix. It comes out what we call the barrel, the products that come out of the barrel. Okay, that slate, they try to optimize that, given the quality of crude that they have in the equipment they're running. And so I'll let Mike Azia walk you through the details of that.
You have, I don't know if you have the numbers, but when speaking about the military, what percentage, what usage do they demand of the total output of what we're refining right now? How much of that has to go to the military? I mean, they use jet fuel, they use diesel, they use gas.
And this is in peacetime.
Yeah, exactly. So what are they using now, I mean, as far as a percentage of output?
I would have to look that up. I think that's in our study, and I think it's around 8 to 12% of the output.
Part of the problem, I'll interrupt here for a second. Part of the problem is it's classified, so we don't know what their usage is, but we can only guess.
Oh,
that makes sense.
Yeah, it's about 8 to 12%. What we know about, for example, we know that Travis burns through about 200,000 gallons of jet fuel a day, just on normal operations. That's just nothing happening in the world, nothing extraordinary going on, nothing extraordinarily planned in terms of training or any types of exercises. So they go through about 200,000 gallons.
And that's one base out of 40?
That's one base out of 40. Depending on how you count them, you get up into the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, you have small bases, you have big bases, you have, you know, all sorts of little things. And then you have, let's not forget, that's just California. You have significant assets, military assets, based in Nevada and in Arizona. Significant Air Force assets based in both of those states. And in the case of Nevada, pretty much all of it is coming from California. So this entire state is pretty much dependent on whatever happens in California. And whatever price increases are in California, there's like a 97% correlation that the price will increase in Nevada. So we have a profound effect on the neighboring states and on national security.
Mike's got his calculator open. What's your calculator open for, Mike? What are you doing over here?
Oh, I know how much barrels jet fuel Valero produces a day, but I forgot how many gallons that is. So let's multiply that. Back to the professor's point, you know, Travis, if something happens in Taiwan or some other significant theater opens up, you're looking at, a KC-10 extender and a C-5 take roughly 100,000 gallons of fuel. Valero makes about 600,000 gallons of fuel a day.
Oh, boy.
And that's just one sortie between a fuel extender, 100,000 gallons right there. As far as, you know, Arizona, Phoenix is totally dependent on us. And when you look at the percentages in Nevada, well, you're looking at 80, 88%, different numbers. The bottom line is Reno and Vegas are totally dependent on us. So the three major cities, they're dependent on us. So we start running into shortages, which we will do. They're in trouble. Prices, supplies. With regard to the refineries, Valero actually produces more gasoline per barrel of oil than any of the other refineries in the state. It was designed different. It was built differently. So you're going to lose a lot with Valero. Phillips 66 is already down in Wilmington. That takes us down to 8 refineries that are actually up of any size or capacity that are running. Valero goes down. Originally, they were slated to go down in April. Looks like they're going down next month. You're going to lose, like Professor said, the whole supply of jet fuel comes from Valero. And then a bunch of real-world events that have occurred in the last 2 to 3 months since we started embarking on this, me and the assemblyman and professor. You've had a major fire at the Chevron refinery in El Segundo. You had a tanker, a fuels oil tanker bound for Singapore, hijacked in the Indian Ocean. You had a leak on the Olympic gasoline pipeline in Washington, shutting that down for a little while. So the other thing is storms. When I ran the Valero refinery, there were 3 separate times where I actually cut back Valero's crude oil rate because storms in Alaska were holding up the Alaska North Slope tankers from getting to us. A couple times we cut from 135,000 barrels down to 100. One time we were about 6 hours away from totally shutting down because the storms were really severe and we were not getting enough. We can't run on 24,000 barrels a day of crude, San Joaquin Valley crude by itself.
Right.
You have to have supplements. When my wife went to visit her family, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, those big cities in China, typhoon went through, shut down the shipping for 2 or 3 days. So any of these real world events just leaves us extremely vulnerable, leaves the military vulnerable, and like Stan was pointing out, it puts the whole country at risk. If the West Coast is taken out, if our Air Force and Navy can't get airborne, it's all up and down. We know how long the state of California is up and down the coast. Then you're affecting Arizona, you're affecting Nevada. We're in serious trouble. And that was initially why we got together on this, was take away the risk to our civilian population, because there will be major civil unrest. We saw how everybody reacted to toilet paper shortages.
Yeah.
When they get on their little app, Gas Buddy or whatever, and say, okay, there's gasoline over here. They go over there. There's
and
no gasoline.
And
they're going to go crazy. And, all of our metropolitan areas, L.A., San Francisco, Sacramento, Phoenix, people are going to totally go crazy. And the military is going to suffer. The military is, it's been a risk since like 2 or 3 years ago when they shut down Marathon and put Rodeo in, the ConocoPhillips Rodeo refinery, put it on clean fuels, the diesel. That gasoline, that jet fuel, all that production took about 20% out right then 2 or 3 years ago. Phillips 66 in Wilmington took out another roughly 9 to 10%, and Valero's another 10 to 12%. So when Valero finally pulls the plug, between 40 and 43% of our gasoline is going to be imported across the ocean. And with all those things I mentioned, real-world events that have occurred, I forgot about the fire on the cargo ship in Los Angeles. It was so severe they had to pull it away from the port. You damage the port of Los Angeles, we can't get the tankers in.
Can't get them in.
Well, crippling us will be child's play.
And like the professor says, you're down to 12-day supply. Price jumps up $1, $1.50 a gallon.
We'll be lucky if that's all
has
there
those
is.
Numbers better. Well, we get down to 8 days, 7 days. That's where all three of us just totally concur. $8 a gallon is minimum.
Yeah.
The minimum what it's going to be within a few months.
And on that cheerful note, I have to be the fun killer and tell us that we have to take a break.
Yeah, I want to talk about location of these refineries, too, and how it affects regionally the supply and demand.
Sure.
When we return.
Sure.
And just so you have something to stew on during the commercial break, the terrific job that we're doing of making our own special fuel in California to make our own special air that is only over our own special heads is a 1% improvement. All this, we have hamstrung ourselves and walled ourselves
when
off from the world
outside.
For a 1%
cleaner
fuel. God, I can totally tell. Break time. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
For a dream ocean, turn a tender eye. is in bloom. The PR transmissions will resume. I try to push drugs to keep us all dumbed down and hope that we will never see the truth around. Another promise, another scene, another a package like to keep us trapped in greed. All a green belts wrapped around our minds, an endless red tape to keep the truth confined.
Yeah, the green belt wrapped around our minds and the regulation.
Yep, yep. So Mike, with these refineries, I would imagine the Valero supplies the gas for Northern California, or does it really matter where they are, or are they very regional where their supply goes?
Typically, it's regional. With the El Segundo fire, I know a tanker was rerouted from the Gulf Coast away from the East Coast to Southern California, and some jet fuel was routed to Southern California from here. Once Valero goes down, that flexibility is gone. You'll only have Chevron and the PBF refinery Martinez.
So that's where you get into shortages.
Exactly.
There just isn't any.
It's just not there. It's not available.
Right. Wow. Yeah, there's going to be some unrest when that happens. I mean, people depend on their vehicles every day. You expect to go out, turn the key, and go. But if you can't get fuel, you can't go to work, you can't buy groceries.
Well, it impedes all the manufacturing and everything. So let's swerve over into the Assemblyman Ellis lane here. Stan, any recognition of this by the California legislature, the people that are say watching the regulators that are squeezing our lives into
No. What's happening is they're so driven by this green agenda that they will not. All they want is tighter regulations. The Democrats put forth Bill 237, which allowed about 2,000 drilling permits in Kern County and exempted them from CEQA to get to work right away. But 2,000 wells over the next 10 years is a drop in the bucket, 40, 50,000 barrels. But Aaron, I want to go back to your reformulated fuel comment that you made earlier.
Oh yeah.
You know, we're getting, so years ago we spent billions of dollars getting our refineries from low sulfur spec and reformulated fuels, and they call it CARBOB here. And now we're getting so-called CARBOB from India, and we don't have regulatory agencies over there watching how clean they put out their, how clean their emissions are. And then all of a sudden, we're putting this fuel and crude into ships that burn number six fuel oil. And number six fuel oil is loaded with polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons like phenanthracene, cryosine, benzopyrene. And what happens is they put these out in the atmosphere, and 20 miles out when they get out from the port, they kick over to low sulfur diesel. It's hypocrisy at its best.
Boy,
so
no
do
kidding.
You think we might get 1% better air? No. We're getting worse air. So I'm sorry, I had to go back to that, Aaron.
No, that's okay, because it makes no sense. The air above us doesn't, I mean, even children, you know, you don't even have to have this in school, because everyone knows
right.
The air moves around. So the air over California isn't the air over California for very long. So
the jet stream comes right across us.
Yeah, so
the
jet stream
comes right across us from the Pacific.
I guarantee you the air that was blowing me off the trail with the dog right before the radio station is in Ohio now. I mean,
but
Mike's not going to use any fuel going home at all. It's just going to blow him right back to Chico.
But back to your question about nothing's happening. I can put forth any type of legislation I want, but unless I'm a Democrat, it's not going to go anywhere.
God.
This is Professor Michelle.
Yeah,
I can add to that.
Please.
So in hearings back in June, the then chairwoman of CARB, California Air Resource Board, was asked directly, does CARB measure the effect of greenhouse gas emissions for the sources of oil, foreign sources of oil, at the wellhead, and do they measure the greenhouse gas emissions for all the tankers coming across the Pacific? And the answer was, no, we don't do that. So if you think about it, you're adding a significant amount of greenhouse gas emissions due to the 3 to 5 time increase in the number of tankers coming across the Pacific. I mean, it just doesn't seem to make sense to any of us that look at the math and understand the numbers. So the logic is really perverted. Let's not produce oil here, and let's shut down the refineries, but let's import it from places like Brazil. Well, I'll give you an example for Brazil, right, because it has to do with the AB 30 legislation for ethanol. So Brazil produces ethanol from sugarcane. Collectively, the estimates are that Brazil has burned 24 million acres of rainforest and jungles for agricultural production, a significant amount of which is sugarcane for ethanol, which, guess who imports that ethanol? California. So not only are we importing oil from Brazil, and their oil, by the way, is all deep water offshore oil, same way with oil off Santa Barbara Coast in federal waters is all deep shore off. But nonetheless, you know, there's a bit of a hypocrisy among the policymakers and the regulators. Well, you know, we won't do with the full life cycle calculation of emissions. And that's an important factor for us. And we are working on that right now.
To get that information to them, to make, I mean, I don't want to speed to the conclusion here, but like, what do you think will tip the scale for people who have their hand on the lever? Like, is there anything you can see?
No, I think Stan summarized it nicely. You know, he's a Republican, and there's a limited number of Republicans and a supermajority of Democrats. And as in Stan's case, in private, I've had Democrats come up to me and say, you know, Professor Mache, we really appreciate your work. We understand your numbers. They are alarming, but we can't really do much about it. And that's all they'll say. The best thing we can do is bring these issues, which we try to do in our study, Stan, Mike, and I, try to do in our study, bring these issues to the public, bring them to people like you who can get the message out in the public, and then get them to Washington, D.C., to policymakers at the federal level. With the amount of reductions we're looking at in gasoline, the vulnerability to the supply chain that's being created, the number of emissions that are going to result from massive amounts of oil tankers coming across the Pacific, I mean, they'll be parked outside of the waters trying to get in to unload, and heck, you can probably step across them to get to Hawaii. So that's a national issue. And so bringing it to the attention of national policymakers, such as the president, I think is in the best interest of not only California, but also the nation. So we're hopeful that President Trump and his administration takes a serious look at the work that's being done out here.
And that's the biggest part of the problem that we've been working on. With Phillips 66 going down, Valero, we're down. We're at 40-plus percent, 30, 35% of our jet fuel. That's where the vulnerability lies. And these refineries, you can't just start them back up. Valero is extremely complex.
If they shut one down, I mean, you can't just turn the key and turn it back on.
It could take weeks to months to start one back up. And a big problem is qualified personnel. You know, when I worked with Flying J, This is the part that's kind of ironic, was the Democrats back then, Barbara Boxer and Lockyer, they saw the logic in a 3 to 4% loss of gasoline production in California, which Fly and Jay represented. They told Shell, we can't have that. The supplies could have a problem. The prices, you know, it could be price spikes in California.
They already paid too much.
They figured it out at that time.
That's sad.
Some of the most liberal,
Boxer is the smart one.
Well, that's the thing. And they basically forced Shell to sell the refinery to Fly and Jay. But back to my point was a lot of the Shell employees had already set to transfer. A couple came up to Martinez back then, you know, transfer to Texas. Some just retired. And you lose that. You know, the longer it sits, the more you're retired. Once you've got it down and everything's cleared and you don't need operators, you know, they lay them off, they retire, transfer to other facilities. the dynamic with Valero that no one knows or understands is the fact that Valero, with its complexity of within the control room, you have one control room running eight major units. In another refinery, you have one control room and operators running one unit. So Valero, you know, you can get somebody to come help you that's got 30 or 40 years experience, but typically they'll have experience on the CAT unit or the crude unit or the sulfur unit.
Like that's the, like a silo.
Right. Like islands within the refinery.
Yeah.
At Valero, you're starting them all up at the same time. And that's where Valero is very problematic, because once enough qualified people have left Valero, you're going to find, I mean, me, it's been a while, I could probably do it, but, you know, you try to find other qualified people in the whole country
who can run all those different
facets
all at the same time.
At the same time.
And how many personnel does it take to run a Valero?
Well, they have they have 400. I mean, you get down to skeleton crew, probably, you know, 150. You have teams running through. Valero's unique because you did maintenance and you did operations. You did both because
right.
It was non-union. But the thing about the qualifications of running it is you got to have time.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to run it from very qualified ladies and gentlemen that knew the CAT unit, knew the coker, but they worked that and ran all of them at the same time. So, you know, it took four or five years before I was extremely proficient at it. So, in another refinery, it takes you a year or two before you can go in a control room, you know, and start running one of their units. So,
right.
This isn't something where you jump in, you learn how to run the drive-thru, and you go.
Plus you blow up the industry and, you know, people aren't going to necessarily want to flock back to California so they can get, So they can get.
When they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah, ruined again.
And the thing
it's like
is.
Like our sawmills. I mean, mm-hmm. You look at how many industries mm-hmm. we have, where we have done this.
Budweiser,
and now people are like.
Budweiser in Solano County is going down.
I forgot about that. There's that.
That's two big employers in Solano County, just Solano County alone. And then going back to your question about refineries and capacity, I was told a long time ago, and this is absolutely true, what a refinery does, they come back online from a shutdown, they put it up to 6,000 RPM, and they cut it back, throttle back 500 RPM, and you hold that for 3 years. That's their maxed out. They are permitted. There's permitted levels. Valero's originally was 135 when I was there. I think it's 145 now, 145,000 barrels a day. Can't.
Dang, we're out of time. Sorry. We have to go. We have to go to commercials. That's all captivated.
And we're out.
Okay, bye.
Buns and donuts and fruitcake with no nuts. So good you could go nuts.
You're going to have all those things when you get home.
No, now. I want a ball. I want a party. Pink macaroons and a million balloons and performing baboons and give it to me. Now. I want the world. I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear 'em like braids in